We welcome you to another episode of Mill Valley's Curtain Theatre podcast, Behind the Curtain, an official Curtain Theatre production. More information can be found at curtaintheatre.org.
Okay, so we are here with our first episode of season two of Curtain Theatre podcast, and I'm here with Peter Bradbury, our dramaturge. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Dramaturge?
It would normally be dramaturg.
Dramaturg.
It's dramaturgy or dramaturgy. I don't think it matters very much.
Okay.
Although I do wonder sometimes whether people understand what it means. Originally, a dramaturg was a sort of theoretician of theatre and would help the playwright turn words into dramatic structure. But more recently, it's come to mean somebody who has a knowledge of the literary history of whatever play is being performed. And in my case, literary history plus language, since my expertise was in, I did my master's and doctoral research on Shakespeare's sonnets. So my particular interest was the language that Shakespeare uses. And I was interested in differences between modern and Elizabethan language, but my principal interest was simply in the poetry, which seems to stand out above and beyond either modern or Elizabethan language, or at least the common usage of it.
All right, so this production this year is A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah.
This is one of Shakespeare's later plays, correct?
It's a middle play.
It's a middle play. Okay.
Yeah, it's sometime in the middle of the 1590s, 1596. Okay. It was possibly put together to celebrate the marriage of some worthy person.
But you don't know.
A patron.
Okay. This play, I've seen it at least twice, maybe three times, and I am still confused by this play. And I noticed that Michelle, the director, mentions at the end of her director's note to just go down the rabbit hole. And when I read that, my thought is a rabbit hole is insinuating there is a lot that's going to be delved into.
Right.
Is that your experience with this play, that it is?
My experience with the play, it's interesting, as a young student, many years ago now, I rather dismissed it. I had to read all of Shakespeare's plays and write essays on all of them. But I rather dismissed this one. I thought it was a little bit lightweight. Of course, I've changed my mind. And I don't know that I'd ever read it fully as a play written on the page. I'd seen it, and of course I'd seen the Michelle Pfeiffer film of the late
Right, I forgot about that.
Right. 1990s, which was a very condensed version of the play. But I know that this appeals to a whole variety of interpretations and interests. What the whole field of dreaming and fairyland opens up for a lot of directors, I think, is the introduction of darkness and threat and so on, but also a romanticization that happens because we associate that with dreaming in some sort of way. But I think of the play, especially having paid a little more attention to it for these last few months than I have in the past, I'm very interested in the fact that Shakespeare was writing at a time when there were huge changes being made in, or that were coming about in our understanding of the physical universe. Copernicus and Galileo were showing that instead of the sun rotating around the earth and the moon rotating around the earth, in fact, the sun, the earth was rotating around the sun. There were a lot of changes in our understanding of the physical universe. And also, there was a huge move toward taxonomies, by which I mean people were noticing the very small differences between, for example, plants, herbs, medicines, and trying to find a way of categorizing them scientifically. And that was just starting. And that went along with an attempt by people like Burton, who wrote something called The Anatomy of Melancholy, who was trying to find a way of categorizing the differences in people's emotional behavior, or the behavior that's directed by emotions. Yet there was so much in the physical and in the mental universe that people did not understand at this time. It's way, way, way before Freud, for example. And so one of the things that people did was to look closely at the spirit world, what they thought of as the spirit world. Imagine that we are sitting, say, in this room in the late 16th century, and there are no lights except the small light that's produced by candles, no street lights, no car lights, nothing. It's really, really dark, yet a little wind might blow something that reflects a bit of candlelight. And to all intents and purposes, people might have thought that we were living in an animate universe in which unknown and indecipherable creatures were having an effect on the physical world around us. But also human behavior seemed to be subject to a whole variety of factors and forces that do not come from anywhere that people knew about. We, in our post-Freudian world, might think of desire and the ego and the id and all of those sources of things, resentment, all of those things. Yet in the 16th century, they did not have a way of understanding that. And I think that looking to fairyland as a source of influence on people was quite important. But what two extra things are really important. One is that during the medieval period, a lot of writers, including someone called Marie de France, who wrote stories called Lays, L-A-Y-S. She was from what is now called Brittany, but she wrote many of the Breton Lays in which a knight would go looking for the Holy Grail or looking for something and would be waylaid by a woman with extra powers, not unlike a lot of the creatures that we have in Marvel movies, Star Wars, Superman. These are the equivalent of the 16th century fairyland, people, humans with extra powers. And in fact, in the medieval and Elizabethan periods, they were people with supernatural and extra powers who happened to be part human. So the fairies in Midsummer Night's Dream are spirit creatures who happen to be half human, or human enough that we recognize them as human, like Oberon and Titania and Puck, who is a hobgoblin, a particular kind of fairy in the medieval and Elizabethan taxonomy of fairies. The thing that was very interesting, that is very interesting to me about this beautiful woman with superpowers whom the knight meets, is that she is able to make things happen for the knight as long as he remains loyal to her as this creature, but also keeps it secret, because secrecy is a necessary part of a world that is so unknown and so unpredictable. And the importance of this, let's say in Shakespeare's time and in Midsummer Night's Dream, has everything to do with the nature of love and marriage. You will notice that when Midsummer Night's Dream opens, the two opening characters, Theseus and Hippolyta, have just been at war with each other. Theseus says, "I won you with my sword," which means that they were in battle. She's the queen of the Amazons. He was the founder, part human, part god, a founder of the city of Athens. And they have just been at war, but they have reconciled and are getting married. Titania and Oberon, who come in, are also at war over two things. One is a little changeling boy who is not really a major player in the play, but they are both a little jealous of each other's misdemeanors with others. So Oberon makes a note of the fact that Titania has probably slept with Theseus, and Titania makes a point of the fact that Oberon has been unfaithful as well. So they open the play in the play as a couple who are at odds with each other.
Do you mind my asking you?
Yeah, no.
So we open the play with two couples that were warring with each other.
And
about to get married.
Yeah.
And this other couple that's accusing each other of dallying with others. Like, there's a lot of conflict. Do you think, I guess, what is Shakespeare attempting? Does he have a moral? Is there a message he is?
Let me get to that in just a minute.
Okay.
Because Shakespeare does not have single morals. He has a quality that Keats, the poet, referred to as negative capability, which is the ability for people to be contradictory within themselves and to be contradictory with others, their partners, and so on and so forth, without having to resort to that great American temptation to homogenize everything and make everything either happy or whatever it happens to be. Titania and Oberon are not accusing each other. They know. They have a relationship in which they do have affairs with others, Which is, in a sense, allowable because they're fairies.
But aren't they arguing about it at the
They are.
So even though they have this understanding, it's not a peaceful understanding.
It's... You will see that as Tom and Heather are playing these two characters, that one of the things that they're introducing is a sense of humour with each other, of playfulness. Because they're fairies, they're allowed to do anything that they like. But because they're human, there's also a kind of relationship structure that we're aware of as the audience. And Shakespeare plays with that balance between doing whatever they like, sleeping with whoever they like, having an open marriage, if you like, and on the one hand, and on the other, observing the social requirements of marriage. And one of the things about the whole fairy literature of the medieval and early Elizabethan period is that so many marriages were arranged, and so many were determined by who the father wanted the daughter to marry, and a lot of is made of that in this play, as it was in Romeo and Juliet. And what used to happen between both the men and women in a marriage, at least in the courtly societies, is that they may well be in an arranged marriage, but they also had dalliances with the people that they really loved. And this play has a little bit of, well, it engages a little bit with that. Would you like me to stop for a moment?
And this may be jumping ahead, but it does, in this play, Midsummer Night's Dream, it seems like Shakespeare is grabbing on to love and marriage and the social norms of those choices, and then he's going, yeah, but...
He is exploding them. He takes those four young people, Lysander, Demetrius, Helena, and Hermia. And what's interesting about that is that none of them knows each other very well except Hermia and Helena. And at the beginning of the play, the relationship between Hermia and Helena, who have known each other since they were babies, is displaced and put into conflict. But as the play wears on, that conflict is resolved through kind of engagement and through the two girls reminding each other that they had this relationship in the past in a really extraordinary way. But you will notice that where the play opens with the father saying she will do what I tell her to do, or she has a choice of death or living as a nun, that is, she will abjure the company of men, and Athenian law, which Theseus has to, because he's the Duke of Athens, has to implement, supports the father's claim. And that reflects Romeo and Juliet, which is probably written a year earlier, I think, where Juliet's father wants her to marry Paris, and she is in love with Romeo, and we all know about the conflict between the Montagues and the Capulets in Romeo and Juliet, but there is this issue in the play, when we look closely at it, that it is about the father's desire for his daughter to marry well, so that prosperity is ensured for the family.
Right.
And the same happens in Midsummer Night's Dream. Aegeus comes in. He's a courtier in Athens. He says, "Here's my daughter. She will not do what I want her to do. Therefore, Athenian law says she must either die, be executed, or live as a nun for the rest of her life." Yet by the end of the play, the intervention of the fairies, which is very comic, because they make mistakes and they get confused and they drop the liquor, the ichor, in the wrong eye, and so on and so forth. And Puck is Puck, and he follows instructions very well, but the instructions aren't clear enough. And that plays to the whole Elizabethan fascination with taxonomy, with getting descriptions absolutely right. And Shakespeare is clearly playing with that in this play. But that mistake leads to different people falling in love with different people. And what that does is that shows us the absurdity of insisting on marriage and sex, because sex is an important part of it, because that's the only way you have babies. And the whole thing is that genetically you will continue, Darwin called it.
Right, the lineage
of evolution.
Right, yeah. Right. Do you think Shakespeare was also making fun of this attempt to compartmentalize life in such a black and white manner?
I'm not sure that there was an attempt to compartmentalize in a black and white manner. I think that's partly why people entertained the whole world of fairies. That's, in a sense, anachronistic. We have that issue at the moment, particularly with a culture that wants to create good and evil, and so on. I think the 16th century was had a far more complex worldview than we do these days, and that Shakespeare was not trying to make fun of that. The fact that he has a sense of the paradoxical complexity of human life that is still extraordinary and fresh and new today doesn't mean that everyone in the Elizabethan period did. There are other writers who do not have the same sense of complexity and what I referred to earlier as negative capability. There are some. I don't know if you're aware, Greg, of a wonderful book, a huge book of written in poetry called The Faerie Queen, mm-hmm. by Edmund Spenser. Spencer uses the fairy kingdom in order to satirize and discuss, if you like, the Elizabethan period. And the queen of the fairies in Spencer's The Faerie Queen is Gloriana, who is none other than Queen Elizabeth I. And what casting this in fairyland allows him to do is to look at the world of Elizabethan England, the courtiers, all the powerful men who were vying to either tell Elizabeth what to do, or to displace her, or to marry her, or whatever, however they wanted to do things. And Spencer wrote this rather extraordinary, it's a novel length poem, if you can imagine that. But this is a time which did not have movies. It had plays, it had poetry. It didn't have novels as we know them today.
Did Shakespeare interact with this, with Spenser?
There's a lot about Shakespeare we don't know, because we don't have, he didn't write a diary, or if he did, we've never seen it. We don't have his calendar. We don't have his emails or his text messages.
Or Spenser didn't mention interacting with Shakespeare, or, you know, like...
We think they were aware of each other. He certainly would have read The Faerie Queen.
Okay.
Just as he read a lot of the early pieces. Shakespeare, one of the wonderful things about Shakespeare is that he plagiarized. He was the greatest plagiarist of in English literature. He drew on previous writing, medieval writing, Latin writing.
Then what sets his writing apart?
It's partly the poetry, his ability to condense complex human thought and emotion into simple sentences that we can respond to. There is his sense of complexity. When Keats had just been seeing a performance of King Lear, in which King Lear proves to be an extraordinarily contradictory person, as do some of his children, especially Cordelia. And he wanted to describe to his brothers in a letter why he found Shakespeare so extraordinary. And this was Keats writing in 1815. So 200 years after Shakespeare. And this is when he came up with the concept of negative capability, the ability to show the contradictory nature of human beings without trying to reduce them to black and white or to resolve conflict.
I'm wondering, as I'm thinking of the conflicts and the things you've brought up about relationship and marriage and the patriarchy of the time, and as you've, I think, said earlier, and Michelle says in her director's notes, there's a lot of darkness in this story. However, in all the productions I've seen, I think even Michelle Pfeiffer's film, there's this frivolity and silliness. Do you think, like, the is that purposefully written by Shakespeare? As an example, is the choice of her falling in love with an ass, does that have the comical elements in the late 1500s that we currently see in our day?
I think they would have. There was, in the late 16th century, a whole literature that people would have been familiar with that came from poets like Ovid, the Latin poet, and Ovid's Metamorphoses, in which people transform from one shape into another, the whole world of shape-shifting, which is represented in this play by the fairies.
It's okay.
Can I just take a pause so you can cut this
out?
Let me have a... So Ovid's Metamorphoses is a series of poems about gods and people who are half human, half god, and the way they change and shift in order to respond to different factors that are affecting their lives. And Shakespeare plays with that a lot. He loved Ovid, as many people did. He would have read Ovid as a schoolboy, and possibly the way we might watch movies or TV series on Netflix now. And one of the things that that whole world allows Shakespeare to do is to look closely at what was actually going on and was very serious in the society around him and deal with it in a way that distanced him slightly from the material he was making fun of or criticizing or exposing, because he was doing all of those things. So yes, he was dealing with the very serious issues of jealousy and the reasons for jealousy of people who were married to one person and loved another, of resentment and anger over all of that. He was dealing with all of that, but in a fairy way that allows him to do it without actually criticizing real people or real situations, and without compromising the sort of moral expectation. We referred to this earlier, the moral expectation that not all audience, all members of the audience, but the more noble and higher up members of the audience, like Queen Elizabeth herself, would have been aware of.
Why is it that Shakespeare ends a lot of his plays, like this one, with an acknowledgement to the audience, it's a play?
It's a really interesting question, and he does. And in this play, he has the play within a play, not dissimilar from Hamlet. He has the play within a play called Pyramus and Thisbe, performed by these mechanicals. And one of the things about the play within the play is that the people who perform it are always talking about the nature of performing it. And so one of the things that Shakespeare was always aware of was, in a sense, the dramaturgy of what he was doing, the nature of illusion created within a play and its relationship to the audience. And you may notice that in good productions of Shakespeare plays, the actors will often have a stream of conversation with the audience that is independent of their conversation with the characters on the stage. And that is the same sort of thing that you're talking about. In Midsummer Night's Dream, Puck at the end says, well, you know, you may have been offended by some of these things, and in fact there will be people, you know, like the man whose wife is enamored of his best friend, who might well have been offended by the Titania Oberon relationship, or the changing relationship between the four lovers, as they are referred to by theatre people. And so Puck is saying to him, look, don't worry, it's just a play. It's just a play. And here we've got all the fairies. And you know what? If we've offended you, I'll make amends somehow, because I'm a theatrical character. We'll do something about it. And it allows... It's like taking the thing of a pressure cooker, because Shakespeare pressure cooks the human experience in his plays. And that steam has to go somewhere at the end. In some tragedies, it's called catharsis. But in comedies, it's reconciliation. But the reconciliation in this is not complete. The fairy kingdom is still there. And so he talks to the audience, Puck talks to the audience, and does that reconciliation in a different sort of way.
Do you have advice for someone like myself who is easily confused by this production? Is there a lens that you could lend to me to enter this as an observer?
Michelle was quite right. Be Alice. Let yourself be Alice. Jump into the rabbit hole and let it take you with it. It is true that there are productions of this play that are confusing. But it doesn't have to be. And one of the really interesting things about Michelle's production, and we've already had two performances of it, is that it is very clear and simple in the transitions between the different worlds that are represented in it. And just go with it. And I'd say that with Shakespeare. One of the things that's really interesting is that Elizabethan English is in some ways quite different and in subtle ways, ways that are not immediately obvious. Yet if the actor understands what she or he is saying, then even if the audience is not familiar with a way of saying things or a word or an image, the actor's understanding will transfer to the audience. And I think if you just allow yourself to be taken along with what's going on stage, then that will allow you at the end to say, I may not have understood that, but now I know where we are. And I think you will experience that. And that depends on a good production. And this is a pretty good, this is a very good production.
Is there anything that has not been touched upon that you'd like to have a part of this?
No. And the things that interest me, I love thinking about the world of fairy because it has persisted from the first recorded words. In the beginning was the word. For many cultures in the beginning, you name things. And we try to understand things, and therefore we get the world of myth, whether it's Roman myth, Latin, Roman myth, Greek myth, Christian myth,
African myth,
Chinese myth. Every culture has a myth appear or a mythology that allows them to explain what appears to be inexplicable. Now we have physics and string theory.
Quantum physics.
Which does something relatively similar.
Yes, that's true.
But also, just as the medieval period, for example, looking at English literature, had Arthur and Camelot, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, it had the worlds of fairy as well. And right up into, the 16th and 17th centuries. But the 19th century, in a sense, reinvented the whole world of fairy in a new way. And that is a world that we are all familiar with. In Peter Pan, Tinkerbell came out of that world of fairies. Not in the cute Disney form necessarily, but in well, it's always been a little bit cute. But then post-war, we had a temporary period in which the heroes in movies and novels were silent men who had suffered greatly, and who moved into a community, made everything right, and then moved on. But that lasted in the 50s and 60s, and it was Henry Fonda and
Clint Eastwood,
John Wayne, and the early Clint Eastwood, and so on and so forth. But that shifted in American culture, in particular, in the late 60s, early 70s, with Star Wars and the whole mythology based on Marvel characters, Superman, Batman. When we think about the half-men, half-god characters of Greek and Roman myth, you know, Hercules and Agamemnon and
Achilles
and Jason, the Argonauts, right, and so on and so forth. Now we have all the Marvel heroes, and of course they've been feminized in a way that they weren't originally, with Scarlett Johansson, for example, who has become a, I don't know to what extent she's feminist, but certainly a very female, half human, half god. And so we're doing very much the same kind of thing, which allows us to stand back and create a facsimile of the world that we live in, which is different.
As you're talking about themes changing and adapting as time continues on, one question that comes to my mind is, Midsummer Night's Dream a prologue to The Tempest?
In what way?
That if you took Midsummer, which is seems very broad, a lot of characters, a whole lot of themes going on, and you distilled it down, and you end up with the father and the daughter and this fairy creature on an island.
Ariel, yeah.
That seems logical.
It does. And Miranda in The Tempest says, "Oh, brave new world that hath such people in it." And one of the things that The Tempest does is to move outside of domestic England, and acknowledges the rather interesting factors that are coming from the exploration of the new world. And so The Tempest is different from Midsummer, in that it is more expansive, in that it is looking at a different world than the one that Midsummer Night's Dream looks at.
Is the theme of marriage, sex, relationship, father daughter still? Well, father daughter's obvious. Let's go like sex, marriage, relationship. Is that part of Tempest?
Yes, it is in a mild sort of way, but there is a sense in which, in The Tempest, the relationship between Prospero and Miranda is very different from the relationship between the fathers and daughters in earlier plays. And there is a sense in which Prospero has learned from his own suffering how to be with his daughter and how to develop a relationship with her which is not based on the patriarchal notion of command.
Do you think all along through Shakespeare's writings he had a sense of equality is important in life and attempting to communicate to this huge patriarchal energy, you're mistaken?
I think, again, there's a little anachronism in imagining Shakespeare playing with the concept of equality in the way that we do. I suspect he probably did not, but I think what was so wonderful about, or is so wonderful about Shakespeare, because his work allows us to live with him in a way, is that he has the ability to recognize the truth and beauty in everybody. And without some conceptualization like diversity, equality, or whatever it happens to be, he gives people their proper due and allows people to be who they are. And he gets into the complexity of the way people feel and think. And what I think many of us love Shakespeare for is that in a world that had a tendency to portray women as second-class citizens in a way, Shakespeare gave us some of the most full characters who were women, and there were too few of them in Shakespeare, but those who are there are really, truly great. And that's partly a testament to Elizabeth, but it's also a testament to women writers of the period, Philip Sidney's sister, the Countess of Pembroke, was a great writer, and in fact some people among those who wonder whether or not Shakespeare wrote the sonnets have wondered whether or not Philip Sidney's sister Mary Sidney, Duchess of Pembroke, actually wrote them. It's an unanswerable question, but it's because we have absolutely no evidence one way or the other, but it is certainly true that Shakespeare would have been aware of really interesting writing that was going on by women at the time. And he would have known quite a few women, and I'm sure he admired Elizabeth. There is some kind of evidence for that in the way that his female characters resemble some aspects of Elizabeth. But yeah.
This feels like a good place to wrap up. So thank you for your time, Peter. And we hope to see you all at the play.
Yep. Thank you, Greg. I hope people go. It's a really worthwhile play to go and see. Actually, what I mean is it's a worthwhile production. It's a really good production. And it really does give a sense of what this play is all about. And I love it for that. So thank you. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Thus ends this episode of Behind the Curtain, a production of the Curtain Theatre. The Curtain Theatre of Mill Valley, California, provides free outdoor theatre during the summer in Old Mill Park, focusing on Shakespeare and other classics. We do so out of love for great drama, and in the belief that the gathering of audience and artists around great plays in this intimate and beautiful setting adds immeasurably to the quality of life in the community. We exist gratefully through the city sponsorship of the Mill Valley Arts Commission and Parks and Recreation Department, along with generous community donations. Information is available at curtaintheatre.org. If we do meet again, why, we shall smile. If not, why then, this parting was well made.